Well, we are almost on time, and I would like to introduce the third speaker. By the way, if some of you didn't realize it, at that time, helium-3 was not very readily available, and it became available only about 2 or 3 years before the predictions which we are celebrating today. That's because of the incourtesy of the hydrogen bomb. And the story of that is another session. I would like to introduce our third speaker, and our third speaker is Joseph Serene. Historically related puzzles in helium-3, in helium-3 spin fluctuations, I'm latex over here, the specific heat and the superfluid phase diagram. Hello, Serene.
Thanks, George. Is the mic okay?
Okay.
The first thing I want to say is that if you look at the printed program, my current affiliation is missing, which is kind of odd because I'm at the American Physical Society. And so, I should also say that on this occasion, anything I say represents my views and not those of the APS. When I got George Zimmerman's invitation, this is how it read. You can see it there, and I was a little bit concerned about accepting it. By and large, I knew the talks at these sessions are about people's own experience, and although I knew the work that he was talking about, which happened in the sort of mid-60s, when it occurred, I was an undergraduate, and only learned about it much later, so I really was a little hesitant. But then I thought about it a bit and realized that although I didn't have any part in this work, I did have a part in work later on that built on this, and so maybe I could put these two things together. Now, the danger in that is that it ends up being an enormous chunk of intellectual turf, and I may have to talk very fast to even have a chance of touching it lightly. There was a subsequent part communication from George that gave me a little more help because it suggested that I could talk about how things, not like a real historian, but about how things look to me, even these past things from the early 1970s. And so that's my excuse for anything that I leave out and get wrong. And I was also comforted because the same communication said that Phil was going to be on the program, and I realized that anything I got wrong, he would correct. So I look forward to that. So this is a kind of a historical outline of what I'll talk about. This early stuff on the specific heat and spin fluctuation theories, then the work that I was part of on the superfluid phase diagram and spin fluctuations after the discovery of helium-3, and I may or may not get to the later developments. We'll see how fast I go. But I'm not going to do this historically. I tried that, and it seemed too much like a history lesson. So I'll actually start in the middle where I was part of the story, and then I'll jump back to tell you about this when I had to learn about it. And I also wanted to say that I'm going to talk a lot about what went on at Cornell, and I thought it was useful to tell people who was in the theory group or passing through the theory group at Cornell at this time. It was a remarkable bunch of people, and they're not responsible for anything I get wrong, not all of these people worked on superfluid helium-3, but they all discussed superfluid helium-3 with me and with everybody else who was working on it, and I think everybody up here, I know I remember discussions with, and they were in a certain sense part of this conversation. Finally, there were also a group of people at Bell Labs working on this problem, Phil and Chandra Varma, Bill Brinkman, Gene Blount, and Dick Wertheimer, and maybe some others that I've again forgotten. I've only listed theorists. I think Dave Lee will talk about experimentalists. To understand this story, you sort of have to realize that there was, at least from the Cornell side, a very strong competitive spirit vis-a-vis Bell Labs. I think they were regarded as sort of the New York Yankees of condensed matter physics. So that made life interesting and lively. So the story began for me in the winter of late 1971 and early 1972 when superfluid helium-3 was discovered at Cornell, but of course it was discovered incognito because the experiments were done in a Pomeranchuk compressional cooling cell, turning liquid into solid and cooling the whole mixture. And everybody had forgotten about the possibility of superfluid helium-3, it seemed, and were looking for transitions in the solid. And when they saw something, that's what everybody assumed it was, a magnetic transition in the solid. Of course, it didn't really look like one. And I remember clearly Michael Fisher running around, he was the great local guru on thermodynamics, trying to concoct stories how this could be a magnetic phase transition in the solid, and not with total success. And this just shows the actual initial experiment with the so-called the pressure going this way, so you're compressing, the temperature's dropping. This is the normal stuff. Here's the first transition. Here's the second one. And unimaginatively, perhaps, labeled A and B. So this stretch in here is the so-called A phase, and everything below there is the so-called B phase. And now looking at this, we realize this is a second-order transition, and this little hysteretic kink here is a first-order transition, but none of this was clear at the time. Well, none of us look back at the old work you've heard about, because we all thought this was a solid transition. And in fact, my recollection is that I was a graduate student with Vinay Ambegaonkar, and we were trying to think of something for me to work on. And we didn't start to work on this because we weren't sure what it was, but we didn't have any good ideas. And it sort of went that way until the summer of 1972, when suddenly this all got clear because Asheroff, Gully, Richardson, and Lee did NMR experiments in a staggered field. And when they did that, you could see where things were happening. And it turned out they weren't happening in the solid at all. They were happening in the liquid. There were three striking features. First of all, by integrating the NMR signal, you could see that the susceptibility in the A phase wasn't changed. You could see that the susceptibility in the B phase was reduced from the A phase susceptibility. Remember, all these experiments were along the melting curve at this point. It was a while before anybody got... I think it was John Wheatley's group that first got to lower pressures. And finally, there was this mysterious shift in the transverse NMR frequency in the A phase with a temperature-dependent shift that started from zero and grew continuously. Well, at this point, it got interesting, and we did go back and look at the earlier work. And in fact, I think one of the first papers we looked at was the paper that Phil talked about. And the important thing to note here is that, first of all, you learn from this paper, that, as Phil said, the not surprising fact that any even L spin singlet superfluid has a reduced magnetic susceptibility. So that couldn't be helium-3A, at least. And then there were the next possibility were the odd L ones, and they had looked at the L equal 1 spin triplet state. They looked at a very particular one, as Bill says, Phil says. It's an example of something called an equal spin pairing state, where there are with the right choice of spin axes, spin up and spin down pairs in this spin matrix order parameter, but not the MS equals 0 spin part of the spin triplet. And they'd found at least one of the best ones of these, and it's this one called one shown here, which is normally now called the Anderson-Morel state. And the nice thing about that was that its susceptibility is, again, as Phil pointed out, isn't reduced, and you can see that should be true for any equal spin pairing state. So that looked good for helium-3A with one small problem, which was a few years later, Baliana Wertheimer had looked at this problem again. Again, all in the framework of generalized BCS pairing theory. And what they'd shown was that the state with lowest free energy was always going to have some of these MS equals 0 pairs. And again, it's just for the reason that Phil gave, that if it pays to have pairs of a given L, it pays to have as many as you can get, basically. And you can get more if you can use all the components of the order parameter. And this state, no matter how you orient its spin, again, has a reduced susceptibility. So
the question of what's A is back there again. On the other hand, this was a reason to go back and look at calculations of the pairing interaction and transition temperature, because if this is pairing, it has to be spin triplet. It's the only way you cannot have the A phase susceptibility reduced. And so we went back and looked and found that there was a literature on spin fluctuations in pairing, which suggested how you might get triplet pairing. And the idea is quite simple. Helium-3 has a strongly enhanced spin susceptibility, and just very intuitively, that means that interactions like for spins to be parallel. Right? And so, not surprisingly, these spin fluctuation induced interactions favor spin triplet pairing and disfavor spin singlet pairing. And the idea basically is that a quasiparticle runs around with a little cloud of polarization around it, and if it comes close to one with the same spin, they like each other, and if it comes close to one of the opposite spin, they don't so much. Well, you look at this, and then what I discovered, of course, was that there was a huge literature behind these papers, which most of my colleagues and teachers at Cornell knew, but I didn't. So I had to go on a very rapid self-educational program. And so now we get back to the topic that George asked me to talk about. So I will try to discuss this, to survey it quickly. This is just background. This is the slide you can almost ignore. It's just to remind you that the Landau theory says that the low-lying single particle excitations are like those of a Fermi gas, except they have an effective mass, and they have a molecular field contribution to their energy, and you can expand this in Legendre functions, and you get a list of parameters, and you only need a certain number of them. In particular, the enhanced susceptibility comes from roughly equally from the effective mass and from this stoner-like correction. And then you can go on and look at the specific heat. Now, we all learn how to calculate the specific heat of a Fermi gas at some point in not quite elementary school, but early on. And this is just what comes out of the Sommerfeld expansion. The first thing that comes out is a linear term. In this case, the coefficient, again, carries the effective mass enhancement. And the next term is something proportional to t cubed, and you pick up all odd powers of t in this asymptotic expansion. Well, as experiments had gotten better and better through the late 50s and into the 60s, these are very difficult experiments, and I say bedeviled by thermometry. They certainly were. You know, thermometry in this temperature range is a terribly difficult business, and it has bedeviled experiments for a long time. But through all that, as the experiments got better, it became clearer and clearer that this wasn't really right, and that there were corrections to the specific heat that did not have this analytic form. So the question for theorists then was, well, where does this non-analytic stuff come from? And I think the first person to notice this and make a suggestion was, again, Phil Anderson. Phil has long been interested in the possibility of the failure of Fermi liquid theory, and I think this was maybe his first suggestion of that. And he suggested that this might come from coupling to zero sound modes. Now, that's a good suggestion because it's known that a non-analytic term comes from that, from the electron-phonon interaction. Eli Ashberg had done that at some point. But when that was worked out for helium-3, it turned out not to work. However, once you have coupling to collective modes in mind, well, you know, if you don't have a collective mode, the nexus thing is maybe a wannabe collective mode. And the enhanced susceptibility of helium-3 meant that there ought to be these spin fluctuations around, overdamped, not propagating modes, things called paramagnons, and a number of people tried to see if that would do the job, and the three that I would particularly note are Doniak and Engelsberg, Riedel and Brinkman and Engelsberg. They did their calculations in a simple model with a zero range repulsion and working in the RPA. Everybody understood that this was some sort of effective interaction, and nobody was quite sure what you should put into it, but that's what was done. And when you do that, you find two things. You first of all find that this contributes to the effective mass, because it says that a quasiparticle drags a cloud of these paramagnons around with it. And the second thing you find, more interestingly, is, I guess I'm blocking that, aren't I? Is that if you look there are processes that come from repeated scattering of particle hole pairs with small total energy and momentum. And these things yield a non-analytic contribution to the specific heat of the form T cubed log T. This is the paper of Brinkman and Engelsberg, which is basically got this story right. There were complicated questions of getting all the proper diagrams and getting all the weights right, but Stan and Bill did that finally, and this is their expression for the spin fluctuation free energy, and this shows the processes included. These little things here and the ladder risers here are the susceptibility of the non-interacting susceptibility of the helium-3. And if you take this thing, and the overall coefficient is a little bit of a fudge, because there's the question of what that I should be, and also there's a cutoff of momentum that you have to fix. But if you give yourself the freedom to fit that overall coefficient, you do a pretty good job of fitting the specific heat. This shows the Abel Black Wheatley measurements. These little dots that look like dirt. I'm sorry, but this is how it came out of Physical Review, and these are the fits with that T cube log T term. So this all looks pretty good. However, there's an immediate question that comes up: Is this really does this stuff represent a breakdown of Landau theory, or somehow can it be brought under the Landau theory umbrella? Now, there was a reason to think that you might be able to do that by sort of following the path that had been done for the original Fermi liquid theory by Landau and his school, and also with help from Luttinger and Ward, that had been done beautifully for BCS by Tony Leggett. And the idea is that you look for you try to isolate in a Green's function theory, in a formal theory, all the low energy stuff that gives you non-analyticities or whatever of whatever is of interest, and then you hope that you can absorb everything else into effective interactions. In modern language, you can think of these as the renormalization group effective interactions that you get by integrating out all the high energy stuff, and hope that this all hangs together. And it turned out you can do this for this problem. And it was again, there was a lot of work on it. There was a first piece of work at Cornell, actually, but later work by Pethick and Carnero that really got this right. And although there's been much subsequent work on this problem, I think the current consensus is that the Pethick and Carnero answers are absolutely correct. So ends my diversion. And we come back to the present, meaning the present of the summer of 1972. And we go from this kind of pretty neat story to a story which, of course, at that point, oops, I didn't want to go quite there yet, was neither neat nor pretty. Nobody knew what the A phase was. Nobody knew what the B phase was. If the A phase was the Anderson-Morel state, nobody knew why it was there. And also, there was this confusing business of the NMR shift. At the end of the summer of that summer, there was the LT13, the 13th low temperature conference in Boulder, which I remember going to, and there was a session there on NMR where there was a presentation by Phil and Chandravarma and also by Mike Richards for Tony, and we all went home from there and tried to figure out if these were the same thing and if either of them was right or whatever, and I worked on this a lot that fall and couldn't quite make it all hang together, and I remember Phil came through Cornell at the end of the year on his way from the Cavendish, I think, back to Bell Labs, and we had spent a day discussing this problem, and came to a little clarity on it. And I think while he was there, Phil mentioned that he had this idea for what stabilized helium-3A, it showed up quite soon in a preprint, and
was later published. This was I lost it when I clipped this out. This was actually received in January, so this things had already slowed down a little bit at PRL in those days. But it was a beautiful idea, and the idea was at that point we all believed there was this spin fluctuation exchange interaction that looks something like this, right? I mean, it's just a RPA-ish kind of expression, and this chi is supposed to be it's the chi that you would calculate without Tony's corrections for the superfluid. And the very naive idea is that we know that pairs can modify chi, and in particular, if you just look at the static Q equals zero susceptibility, the thing that gets measured for the BW state, we know that chi is reduced. So if you plug a reduction of chi into here, you see that this interaction is weakened, and that presumably reduces the stability of that state. On the other hand, if very naively you just observe that the Anderson-Morel state susceptibility isn't changed at all, it looks at the very least like it doesn't suffer, and so this might help to fix that imbalance. Well, what Phil and Bill Brinkman did was to make a not bad educated guess for delta chi, plug it in here. Do a sort of perturbation theory to get the free energy from the change in the interaction, in the weak coupling interaction. And what they found when they did with this guess at delta chi was that indeed the free energy of the superfluid free energy of the BW phase state is increased. But they actually found that not only was the Anderson-Morel one actually decreased when you're a little more careful with all the components of this susceptibility, and that you could stabilize the Anderson-Morel state. So that was really great, great news, and as they say, a really inspired idea. But of course, Cornell being Cornell in those days, with competitive spirit, there were many questions raised immediately. The most obvious one was the form Phil and Bill had used for the change in the susceptibility. And on this one, you didn't have to look too long to see that it couldn't be exactly right. Now, the question was, if you did it right, would you really change the answer? So I think they knew it wasn't exactly right, too. So that was one big question, and it was an obvious one that really did have to be answered. Another one was, had the trick that they had used to go from the change in the interaction to the change in the free energy, was that exactly right either? Because you know, this is one of these many body things where you have to be careful that in going from essentially from self energies to free energies, it's not an entirely trivial business. Another correction was whether there were other corrections from this delta chi that you ought to worry about. After all, the spin fluctuations also contribute to the effective mass, and those corrections also might be different for the two states. And it wasn't clear that those had been included. Did you have to worry about those? And then finally, if you're going to take seriously this momentum and frequency-dependent interaction, do you have to worry about the conventional kind of strong coupling corrections, as in the strong coupling theory of superconductivity? Well, various people worked on this in various ways. Vinay, I remember, was very concerned about whether spin fluctuations and pairing fluctuations were being treated consistently. He'd recently done work on the fluctuation diamagnetism in superconductors, and this was kind of on his mind. So he went off to try and do this problem with the Hubbard-Stratonovich trick of coupling to fluctuating fields and using both fluctuating pairing fields and fluctuating spin fields. That turned into a bit of a mire, because it turns out that once you try to do that, you can break up this interaction in various ways into pairing parts and fluctuating parts, and depending on how you do that breakup, you can, if you aren't careful, you can get a variety of answers. But I was sent off just to try and check this in old-fashioned Green's function language,
So I did. I went to work on that and worked on it for the next couple of months. There was a lot else happening in these next couple of months. Tony came to visit Cornell and put the finishing touches on his beautiful theory of NMR, and that took a lot of our attention. The zero sound attenuation was measured, and the peaks due to coupling to collective modes were discovered, and Peter Wurfle produced an explanation for them, all of which occupied a lot of our attention. But by the end of the spring, I'd gotten a good ways, and at that point, Vinay went off on a trip to Europe for the most of the summer, and so I kept working. And at the end of the summer, I went to the Gordon conference. The conference picture is here. It happened at the Brewster Academy in Wolfboro. It's not a very good picture. I just got it yesterday from the Gordon conference folks. There are a few interesting people here. There's a very young Bob Richardson. There's Pierre Hohenberg. Dave Lee is up here in the back somewhere. There's Dave, I think. Sandy Fetter's over here someplace. Anyhow, you can look for your friends in this picture. Many, many people were there because this was an exciting time for low temperature physics. But when I was there, I met Bill Brinkman, and we got to talking and discovered that we had done essentially the same thing, to a remarkable extent. I mean, we had the same answers. We had discovered a lot of the same tricks for doing the calculations. And Bill said, look, this is silly. Why are we doing this independently? Why don't you come to Bell Labs and we'll finish it together? So I went back to Cornell, and I remember I asked David Merman and John Wilkins if I should do this, join the dark side or whatever. And to their credit, they both said, of course you should. What a wonderful opportunity. So off I went to spend a couple of weeks at Bell Labs and working with Bill and with Phil a little bit, looking over our shoulders and keeping us on track. And we did, in fact, produce the correct version of the spin fluctuation theory with the little oversights in the original paper corrected. I should say, Kuroda in Japan did more or less the same thing at the same time, although we had no idea of each other at all. This shows again these same spin fluctuation diagrams with the super fluid corrections put in. I should mention that there was kind of a surprise when we did this calculation, because it turned out that just as before, that the free energy of the Anderson-Morel state was decreased, but the surprise was the free energy of the BW state was also decreased. So the naive argument, unfortunately, isn't quite right. But the picture was right. And as you looked at lower temperatures, you found that these spin fluctuation corrections relatively dropped, and you got a transition back to the BW state at lower temperatures. And it's a lovely picture. I just go on very quickly to say that, but I wasn't done with questions, because Dirk Reiner, who was a postdoc at Cornell, had this long string of questions for me. Why did you just do these diagrams, right? Why did you pick these? What's special about those? What about this frequency dependence? And can this fit into Landau theory? And we worked on that as collaborators for a long time, and eventually were able to do the same thing for this that was done for the T cubed log T stuff, and show that you really can do this, that there's a small parameter, it's basically TC over TF. We'd actually guessed this in the BSA paper in the context of spin fluctuation theory. And when you do that, you get this kind of long-looking set of diagrams, but the point is that these things, all the explicit Green's functions are quasi-particle stuff that you can do, and all the circles are once again these. It's just the scattering amplitude for quasi-particles on the Fermi surface in Fermi liquid theory. And so this story ends up, in the end, looking a whole lot like the earlier one. And in both cases, although spin fluctuations told us how to do it, they turned out to be only part of the actual story in the end. Then I will stop.
Done?
I'm done.
Thank you.